Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For the last 8 years, nearly 350 interviews, Art of the Cut has been talking with the world's best editors in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Today, we're speaking with the cinephile who goes by the nom de plume Kogonada. He is both the director and editor of the beautiful and haunting film After Yang. Kogonada's previous film, Columbus, was released in 2017 to critical acclaim. It was nominated for the Independent Spirit Awards for both Best First Feature by a Director and Best First Screenplay. The Chicago film critics named him Most Promising Young Filmmaker, and he was nominated for the Audience Award at Sundance, among dozens of other accolades. Before his directing debut, Kogonada received numerous commissions for his innovative and thoughtful video essays and installations on film, working often for Sight and Sound magazine. Many of these videos are available on YouTube. The transcribed blog post of this article has many of the links, and I highly recommend that you search them out. They will broaden your appreciation for cinema. I'm excited to talk to you. I don't often get to talk to directors. And first of all, you are a real cinema lover and a student of cinema, which I think is very evident in this beautiful film. Did you have any specific muses or inspirations for this of your cinema favorites?
Yeah. There are always, and who knows when it will fade, there's always a collection of filmmakers that I want to be in conversation with, but I would never feel worthy to be in the conversation, but just sort of hiding in a corner, being in a conversation with, and certainly Ozu and Edward Yang and Wong Kar-wai. And there are a lot of Asian filmmakers that, because of so much of my own sense of being and my own sense of identity, has been through the conversations of these films as well. But Truffaut, you know, there's just so many filmmakers and films that have stayed with me. There's one film, though, in particular, that I realized that this film is so much in conversation with, and I've seen it so many times. And I'm trying to think if there was a moment when I brought it up to anyone, because it's so much in conversation with the film, but it may have just been because it's just buried inside of me. But just recently, I had a chance to program a double feature with my film, and I chose Afterlife by Koreeda Hirokazu. And this film is so much in dialogue with that film. And so that certainly is one. But God, I could just talk about so many filmmakers that are inside of me that I'm sure as I was making it, it was seeping through all the choices that I made, and even in the writing of it. There's a Japanese film called All About Lily Shushu, which is referenced directly in the film. And there's a documentary called All in This Tea that is also referenced in the film. So there are some direct references as well. But Ozu is always a part of what I'm trying to understand. But this is such a different film than any Ozu film. And the long-winded answer to that question.
No, that's exactly what I want. This is an in-depth discussion. And I definitely want to talk a little bit about editing, which I loved the editing of this. I really did. But why not bring in another editing voice? What was your decision to edit this yourself?
Yeah, because we're going to talk about editing, I can't believe I didn't mention Alain René and also Soderbergh, who I think is a big fan of Rogue and René, because the memory editing, the human memory with the echo and repetition was like, I was so excited about that formal element in the film, because I'm such a fan of the way all three of those filmmakers will play with editing to capture a certain kind of subjectivity of time and experience and memory. So they were definite references when I was thinking about one element of this film.
Yeah, that makes so much sense with one of my questions that I will ask later about that repetition, but your decision to edit for yourself.
Yeah, because it always has felt like the cooking part of a meal. I've always felt everything else is about getting the best ingredients you can. And then you finally try to make something with those ingredients. And editing is how I entered this field with these essays, and is just a skill that I learned, and it felt very intuitive. And so I've thought quite a bit about the cut, and I've worked on documentaries. I think so many editors really make incredible documentaries out of a collection of footage. and obviously with the director as well, but there's some real work that editors do in creating meaning. And having that experience and feeling so affectionate about even the amount of frames when you cut, and sometimes it's just like, oh, three frames here feels right. So there's something so intimate about it, so personal, that at that point in my life, I wasn't willing to give it up. And I have been in a position at times where someone else is doing it, and you feel like you're burdening them by saying, could you try three frames back, you know? And so it was really about me at a particular time, really not ready to let go of the intimacy and the decision-making and the minutiae of editing that I love. Now I'm like several years from that moment, and you know, you meet great editors who share sensibilities. And I'm more open than ever to the value of an editor who can also be in conversation with you. The one thing, I've never edited something this long. My first film I did, you know, the first pass was almost 3 weeks. It was very quick. When I direct, I know how I'm going to cut a scene. And so that process can go fast. But this film I was in for months, which I guess is normal for most projects, but I was largely doing it alone. I had an assistant editor, but we were separated geographically. And yeah, I could also see the value of being in conversation, because there were moments where I felt very lost in my edit as it goes.
Yeah, that's one of those places that I feel like an editor is a value. I can definitely understand your desire to be more intimate with the material, not to have a barrier between you and doing what you want to do. That makes total sense. But that conversation, or to have another set of eyes or another brain, that's where I would find it hard to deal with. Somebody's asking me to direct, and they said, do you want to edit too? I'm like, no, if I direct, I don't want to edit. No.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I think I'm going to try to figure out what the balance of that is, because I also understand, and this is true for all my department heads, I hate being micromanaged by someone. I've been hired for something and people trust me. I want to give them space. So I would really want to work with someone where I don't feel like they're just doing what I'm asking them to do, since I know how to do that, that they could also offer their insight and sensibility. But there's a part of me that wants to know that if I wanted to work on it for a bit, that every change wouldn't have to be me saying, could you try this? And that I could just have a, you know, pass at it, so that I could even explain to the editor something that I am trying to work on. I just did this series for Apple TV, and it was the first time that I didn't edit something that I directed. And yeah, the editors were great. And I could see there were times where I was just dying to edit sequences, but I also could see the value, real value of a great editor. And also, I realize how DIY I edit versus like someone who does it professionally and knows how to use an assistant, and everything, you know, about their process is at a different level of organization, and it feels more substantial in ways that in some ways I edit like I have a film and tape and a scissors, and I try to keep everything on one video track.
Oh, you know, so do I.
Oh, great. See, you would be great then, because I often in this film, I used a dissolve for the first time because I had to, but I really love straight cuts. I really love the art of it being in the way you time it and the way these cuts relate to one another.
Pedestrian question. What NLE did you cut in, and why did you choose that?
I use Premiere because I'm a child of Final Cut. And then when they switched over to X, and I did that a little bit too when I was doing my more video art and essay work, but I used that in the first film, but just transferring it was so messy. I just thought, oh, I'll learn Premiere. That's the closest to what Final Cut looked like. And I use Premiere because of the learning curve seemed quicker, shorter.
I love some of the really deliberate compositions, and the editing choices made me feel that most scenes didn't have a lot of coverage. Is that true? Was there a section about multiple owners?
Yeah. So there was an earlier cut that was in Cannes that was more elaborated. After Cannes, I had actually asked A24 if I could make a few more adjustments, and the more lengthier conversation of that was what was trimmed out. But there is a discussion of at least this beta owner that Yang owned before for 5 days. So that conversation still sort of exists. And what I cut out was never about the alpha ownership, which remains a sort of surprise in the film, but it was a lengthier kind of consideration of that period when Yang was owned by this other family.
like I said, the compositions are just stunning. And because you said before, because I direct, I know how I want them to edit. Do you feel like you use less coverage than most directors would because you know where it's going to go?
Absolutely. I have very limited coverage. One of the things I really realized early on when I got to direct is like shots I would never use. I just wouldn't use it in the sequence. Because sometimes, you know, a DP or someone would say, what about this shot? And I just knew the way I would want to cut it. And so it does eliminate shots. And so I am editing in my head all the time, which is so great because I think when you have to change on the spot, you can start re-editing it and knowing what no longer is needed or what might be needed. Obviously, you have a team around you that's helping you think through that as well. But yeah, my coverage has been very limited in both films. Doing this TV series with a showrunner, you know, it was a real dive into another kind of approach where there are a lot more options that people want. And I've been thinking about that too in the future of my own films. Do I need to give more room for those? Because obviously in the editing room, it's always nice at times to have an option. You're always giving something up. The other thing is that without having as much coverage, every shot you can really make count. You can really make it as detailed. You have more time with every shot as opposed to trying to do a scene and covering it 10 different ways. And it's like, well, what do you want to sacrifice? And I often want to sacrifice option for really trying to capture that moment in the way that you want to and in the best way that you would like to present those scenes.
Beautifully said. Well, let's talk a little bit about a specific, which is there's a discussion of technos when they first go to the museum. And I'm assuming that you had coverage of the discussion, but the discussion is largely covered with these beautiful shots of bodies.
See, this is so nice to talk to an editor. It's such a different way of talking about film, and I so much love that. And I'll be honest, too, that it was the one space in our film that, because you want to make every shot count, you want every space to feel compelling and interesting. And it was a space that was a bit of a struggle, both in finding the space and the design of the space, and even finding angles or shots that felt, you know what I always say, like worth the while of really spending time. And it was one of those expository moments that it existed. And it really was this sort of trying to solve that of being in a space that didn't offer as much value as we wanted it to. And then realizing that, oh, this museum space, which we shot separately, it was a reshoot to capture that display of the techno. And once I had that, I thought, oh, this will help us cover this conversation, but also give that conversation real visceral context. So it became a really good solution.
I know that, especially when you were talking about three frames, right? Everything that you did seemed very intentional in this movie. So one of the intentional things that I wanted to ask about is at the end of the discussion with the museum lady saying she's dedicated her life to Techno Sapiens, she walks away from him and we watch her walk away. What is the value of that walking away?
Yeah, I did this essay on neorealism, and it was about the Terminal Station film, which Selznick was this producer, and he loved neorealism. His wife was a fan of neorealism, so he did this film with De Sica, and then De Sica presented his cut, and he felt like there was too much walking and too much in between moments, and he did his own version of the cut. My essay is really like there's this moment in film where we get to see two different sensibilities and two different values in their cut. And I love international film because they give moments for things that sometimes in Hollywood that feel disposable or excess, which is the way that the time of movement in space. And I have that in Columbus too, of a girl walking down. Obviously, I think of Tati and just so many great films where it's just about an in-between moment. It's just about the moment after the drama or after the information. I don't know. The accumulation of that is valuable to me. It may not be in the sense of story, but in a sense of time. There's just something that has always contributed to my feeling of a space and time in those kind of films. And the films that have stayed with me the most are the ones where the background doesn't feel like simply a setting. It feels like real space. And I don't know why those stay with you, but I think if you don't have a sense of space and time, those experiences can feel very disposable. It's almost as if they don't have the bones to carry memory for you. But yeah, I had to hit her walk all the way and enter the door. So there was me cutting. I did cut some in that scene and I trimmed it even a little bit more after Cannes, but it's still enough, you know? So it's always like for me, like what's enough to feel like I don't want to cut away right away. And obviously there's some subjectivity to that.
And it's also giving the audience a chance to process something that they've heard that was important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's well put. And my DP always, we talk about like palate cleansers and just really having a moment to cleanse our palate for the next thing. Yeah.
Yeah, a little ginger after the sushi, right?
There you go. That's so good. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I love it. Talk to me about the sound design in the memory playback scene. Obviously, somebody else, a sound designer, worked on that. But did you? Yeah. What kind of base did you give that person to work from as an
yeah.
editor?
It was really a contribution with the number of people. I had a real artist kind of design that space for me versus a real traditional VFX house. His name is Raul Marx, and he works with Patrick Clare with Antibody TV, and they do a lot of those opening credit sequence for like Westworld, and I think they did True Detective. They're real artists in their own right. And I knew that I wanted that interface to be not just like a computer desktop interface. I wanted it to have emotion in and of itself, and I wanted it to feel mysterious. So I'd asked Raul to help design it. So I just want to mention him because even in his design of it, he added some musical elements to help us understand the design. And it was so captivating that we replaced it, but it also was influential in the way we thought about it. And then Rui Garcia, the sound designer, we took that and had more conversation and obviously added music to it as well. But yeah, the explanation was that I didn't want it to be full of sci-fi tropey sound effects and that I wanted it to feel organic, that I wanted it to feel spatial. And you hear birds initially, you hear wind movement, and that you start feeling the sound of memories. And we really locating that in the Atmos to really help us feel the search of memory. So it was complex, you know, everyone contributed, really did a remarkable job and took quite a bit of time to create the spatial feeling of these memories.
There's a montage of mini memories. Talk to me about the shot size selection and the sequencing of the shots in that.
I mean, I think that we had this whole idea that we have these human memories that are long scenes and echoes of that scene. And then we have Yang's memory, which I decided that his memories were limited to just a few seconds and that he could only really store a few seconds of memories and that our experience would be in the accumulation of these fragments, that we would get a sense of what he valued and what he was attending to. And knowing that Meimei was his primary responsibility within this family, that we would get a feeling of his time and also that it would be a bit of a sting to Jake too, because as a father, he's struggling with being present. So we knew that it would have this sort of double quality to it, that it would both reveal things that Yang cared about, not only nature, not only these sort of family moments, but that his attention to their daughter was so integral to who he was and how he saw himself. But then also knowing that Jake was seeing through the eyes of Yang and also everything he was missing in his own absence and his own preoccupations.
One of the places, and you kind of alluded to this earlier in our discussion, is this use of repetition and fracturing of time. And one of the first places that's evident is in this discussion of tea. Yang is having this discussion with Jake, like, why do you love tea? Can you talk to me about that use of, you hear him say multiple things and it's even different sounds. Like it's not, one sounds like it's from a lav and another sounds like it's from a boom almost. tell me about the sound design and the jump cutting and repetition.
You know, I knew it was a sci-fi film, and obviously the sci-fi is very, I think people have described it as soft or lo-fi, and I didn't want it to be dominated by tech and a certain kind of sci-fi that exists. And I love some of these sci-fis that are more industrial and tech heavy and monitored and effects heavy. And I wanted to use the language of cinema or the technique of cinema itself to create these moments of reality. So instead of having, let's say when we were in Yang memories, having some graphic that kind of showed the time code or something like that, it was just going to be that we had a different aspect ratio, we used a different lens, and then we used these sort of momentary fragments, and then obviously the interface that would tell us that we were in this space. And with human memory, and I was so excited for this idea that we would get to the subjectivity of it by, I described it to my DP because I didn't tell my actors that we were going to shoot it this way, but I did tell my DP how I was going to cut it. And for us to just shoot these scenes fully and cover one side or the other side, but do multiple takes, because I was imagining memory almost as if we're auditioning the statements to try to get a better sense of the right take of it, that it was almost like filmmaking, that human memory is almost as if you're trying to get to a scene in your life and understand the perspective and hear it again and say, no, that wasn't it. Maybe it was this way. And, you know, my own study of human memory is that every time you recall it, it changes. They say that you never recall the same memory the same way, and you're own subjectivity at the moment might alter your memory. And I think into human memories, what I love is I don't know if you just saw an objective shot of that scene, if it would feel as intimate or as quiet or loving, because now when Jake is starting to recall Yang, he has a different kind of affection for him than when he did at the beginning of the search, when it was almost more like he's just an appliance and I'm annoyed. He has softened up to Yang and suddenly that conversation feels more meaningful. So I love that about it. And the same with Kira, when she's thinking about this conversation about death and butterflies, there's a take where Justin started to cry. He didn't want to cry. He started to cry and he apologized afterwards, but I knew how I was going to cut it. And I had given him permission because he's like, I'm feeling so emotional, but should Yang be this emotional? And I said, let's do a take and don't worry about that. Just be in the moment. And I knew that because it was not an objective memory, that it was subjective, that in Kira's own sadness of now suddenly feeling the loss of Yang, that it may be affecting the way she was recalling Yang's own emotion, and having two takes of it and then returning to one where he's not as emotional. Yeah, I just loved as an editor, you know, it's so different from the rest of the film, but to go back to the filmmakers, I love Soderbergh's The Limey. I love Soderbergh's Solaris. I was surprised because I'm a big fan of Tarkovsky's Solaris, but when he did Solaris, he played temporality in that way. And I just love how it puts you in a space of subjectivity and it's all about the cut. I love that because that subjectivity is not by creating a lens effect that says, oh, we're in this perspective, but it's really about non-linearity. And I love that kind of cinema. You know, Rene Dissed in last year at Marienbad and Hiroshima Mana More, it was one of my favorite parts of the film and cutting the film.
For those editors that are listening to this that might not know you, one of the things that you've been known for before you started directing is these beautiful essays about cinema. So that's for those that might not know what essays you're talking about, right?
Yeah. I mean, really, it's probably the way I was able to break into filmmaking by making these essays and getting commissioned. And I did some installations as well. But the really lovely thing about that experience was it's so experimental. There were no rules at the time and still aren't. And that I could play with a cut. And of course you're using, you know, talk about ingredients, you know, when you're recutting Malick or Kubrick, you're just using the best footage ever. And it's sort of a delight to do that. So getting to play with form in that format was really instructive, not only instructive in regard to the kind of images that they captured, but what is possible. And as someone who, when it comes to films, I've drawn to slower cinema in those essays, you've got a lot of cuts and I could play with that. And I also love the possibility of what happens when you are cutting extremely fast, because it creates its own sort of dynamic experience. So it was really just a great way to think through cinema and think through the cut.
I love it. I've got a question that's more of a directing question. Ada has this first talk with Jake. They're sitting, I think they're in a car, and you chose to use coverage that looks like a shot, reverse shot, which it was, but they're facing opposite directions.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. So what was the choice of doing that? And did you have another one where they were looking at each other? I don't know.
We may have. Again, being a fan of Ozu, he often crossed the line and he was so bothered by what he almost considered the Western burden of continuity, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
As a master filmmaker during these sight and sound pulls, there's a reason why he's just this master filmmaker, and he just made his own kind of cinema that really, for me, resonates at an emotional level. But if you look at his films, he often is switching the lines. And sometimes it can be wholly distracting, but sometimes it's the image and you have already a sense of the orientation, or if the image is strong enough that it won't matter. I mean, there's classically when he does sometimes a scene where two people are across the table and he will mix the eye line up, but he will also have bottles. If you look at a bottle, it'll be jumping around on the table because every shot, he just cared about the shot itself, how to attune yourself to the shot. So he would easily move bottles around because he just wanted to make a certain kind of composition that would orient your eyes to where he wanted it to be oriented to. And of course, you know, the script supervisor would be like, you can't. And he would just like say, no. Care. And in fact, no one does, because now I think if you weren't as mindful of the details, it could be distracting, but there's so much more you're paying attention to in regard to that frame. So yeah, there was a reason in regard to reflection and limitations too about those shots within the car technologically. When making the decision, again, it's always about privileging one thing or over another. And I thought, no, let's not privilege continuity. Let's privilege the best possible shot in regard to our constraints and the reflection. And I do think I had one one that would have kept continuity, but it just felt like it could exist this way. And that's what I want to find in the editor too, someone who also can let go of some of that element, because it's hard, you know, because your peers are going to be like, wait a minute, why did, you know, there's something about the burden of rules and what are conventional, but maybe most editors love it. Maybe they also feel burdened by continuity.
Yeah, I think that I could find some editors that would agree with you. You look at Thelma Schoonmaker, you know, no continuity often. I just saw a video essay about Goodfellas or something where there's just two wide shots that are cutting back and forth and nobody notices unless you pay attention to it. You're like, wait, when one thing he's smoking a cigarette, the other one he's not, he's facing the wrong direction. But you don't feel any of that because you're so involved. Absolutely. Yeah, I love all that. Let's talk about music really quickly. There's a beautiful section in the museum with Jake carrying Mika Maymay, and there's a beautiful slow cello score and held shots. Love that. And then right after that, there are also scenes where you would think there would be score, but there's not. I just love the choices of spotting score. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm still figuring that out and trying to figure out where the balance will be. I really opened myself up to score more, and partly because I was working with Asuka and really is Sakamoto too, who has always been my favorite composer. And Ryuichi Sakamoto was already committed to a project, but he was so gracious enough to create a theme for us. But in my past film, and I think just intuitively, I have shied away from too much score in my films. And I think my first film was very ambient, but the score was lovely. But I remember telling them I almost wanted to come out of the ambience. And sometimes you didn't even know if you were hearing ambience or music. And they did a remarkable job. And I thought, that's probably where I will want to be in making films. But then with this film, it just felt like I needed music more or wanted music more. And then I thought, if I'm working with Sakamoto, again, he's a master and I'm not going to tell him anything except to do what you feel is right. And then he created this incredible theme and then asked the composer, took this theme. It was so lush and moving. And I just saw the value in that. So I'm going to try to figure out continually what the balance of score and silence is, because I think it's critical. So this is me as a filmmaker learning and trying to understand that. But I was happy with incorporating this score. And this particular piece that you're talking about was a vision of Asuka. She had a song that she has always loved and felt like this is the right film for it. And she then added these incredible strings that really, strings in that little piano line became a big part of our film. And she added strings to the Sakamoto theme as well that echoes the strings here. Again, and it's an ongoing process of learning. And I was so glad that I opened myself up to more music, but also finding times for silence. I love ambient sounds, which feel musical to me. I think it's called concrete music. There are albums where it's just ambient sounds. And I mentioned that to my sound designer as well. So there are real moments where you can feel the sounds of birds or the rhythm of something in the background, a transportation system that equally feel lyrical to me and musical.
One of those places that doesn't have score that I really love, because so often score tells the audience what to think, right? There's a scene in the car about Yang being a good brother and struggling about his identity. That's such an emotional scene. No music.
Yeah. And I sort of love the sounds of that tunnel. And you know what I love too, is there is something about car conversations. This is an auto car, but it still carries with us what we know in the present, that sometimes cars are that place where we're most reflective. You know, I didn't mean to be heavy handed on it, but we are almost always outside the car and feeling the reflections pass by. And there's just something about the intimacy of that conversation and so many conversations like that, that I've had, where it's just you and the sound of the road and lost in thought or lost in conversation, that I love. And there's some real nice sounds that Rui created in the tunnels that really deserve a little bit of a highlight in solo sometimes too. So I love that.
Absolutely. The moment of the wife, Kira, she's watched some videos of Yang. She's watching memories. And then there's pre-lapping of her having the memory of being in the memory that she's watching.
Yeah.
Right? Talk to me about that use of a pre-lap and why you use to hear her sound coming from the next scene.
Yeah, it's funny because it was another one of those things that in the writing that I felt so happy about because it existed right there. I think the question was, how do I take this scene in particular? And it's really going to be the first time we see Kira have a memory of Yang. And once I had her sit where Yang sat and see what Yang was looking at when he recorded that memory, I just thought, oh, this is going to lead to the moment right after Yang records this memory. memory. And she's going to make that connection. She's going to make that connection that, oh, this memory I'm seeing was right before I had this conversation. And in that moment, she's going to turn her head like Yang did because she entered that scene. And just editing wise, it was really one of those, oh, I can't wait to edit this. Like, this is a good trend. Like, you know, this is going to lead us into that memory. So it was written that way, you know.
I love it. You mentioned dissolves and your love of a cut. And I think most editors love a good cut. But there's a beautiful section of dissolves in the face matching questions. So there's a sequence where Jake says, oh, match this person's face that I'm seeing and find all the other shots of this person. And instead of, like you said, in a typical sci-fi movie, it would be like glitches. You use dissolves. What was the purpose of those?
Yeah. And to really stay in that kind of, well, what does the language of cinema offer? And I love it. You know, there've been some really classic, incredible dissolves in cinema. And I think it's getting better and it's good to open yourself up. I think I was so almost as a point of pride, I thought I'm just going to always stay with this, you know, like just a cut. But that, you know, I realized in that particular sequence and to set it off from the other elements, but there was something about the mystery of this girl, Ada, and also the history that she has with Yang, and us also feeling that this movement from him first meeting her to them having some sort of relationship. Yeah, there was something about the dissolve that really helped feel the elongation of that from the very first moment to some other relationship and taking it out of some sequence where you'd be like, oh, this is when they met her and now this is 2 weeks later. And I had tried that and I just thought, oh, there's just something about trying to present the linear relationship that felt lacking and almost in some ways too brief in a way. And so once I started blending time and going back and feeling the beginnings and then suddenly dissolving into something that was more established and then getting to play with the head turn, it just made everything more layered, literally layered that relationship. And unlike him recalling the missed childhood of Mika, which I think as parents, you understand, it's almost like you can do that. We know that sort of passage. There was something about the mystery of this relationship that needed another way of presenting their time together and that experience. And so much of editing is also trying to solve an issue, both aesthetically and emotionally. And as soon as I said, okay, what does this look like? It started working immediately. And then it was just a matter of how I was going to play with those layers.
Did you, like many editors might for their director, give yourself alts? Like, okay, I'm going to try this. And then auditioned a bunch of different ways to present that material.
Yeah, I did. Again, I think I can see the value of having a conversation in the alts. You know, you do it for yourself. And I didn't really do it for others. Occasionally, I would say, here's another version of it. But I think that there would be real value of having a conversation with another editor about the alt, because a lot of that was by myself. Although I had a lovely fellow filmmaker that was separate geographically, but he helped initially assist. And so we would have those conversations, but I would like it to be more direct in the future.
I want to jump backwards in time. I loved how you trusted the audience with that tea crystal scene. There's no dialogue, there's no explanation, but you just said, let's give this to the audience and let them experience it. Talk about choosing to leave that in a movie where that's not part of the plot. That scene, it could have been deleted.
For sure.
Why leave it in?
Yeah, you know, and it's this little callback to this moment that, like, it says something about Jake, I think, that where he is in this sort of old way of tea, because we find out that the pursuit of tea for him is so meaningful. Like, it's not just about a commodity for him, but it's really about a pursuit and trying to be connected, which is really this ongoing struggle for Jake and has been a struggle for me sometimes in life, is just feeling connected. And sometimes it's cinema or craft or some idea that can really ignite that for you. And that existed in Jake. But when we find him at the beginning of the film, you can tell he's a little bit lost. So this notion that in the future, there's a much better version of tea, at least that most people think, and he's just, it's not even a part of his world as a tea. So there was some reason that I wrote it for sure, but it was also going back to this realism, like just giving space and time for a person and having a moment with them that doesn't necessarily push a plot or emotional point. But there was this idea that even as this sort of crisis is starting to happen about we need to fix this robot, his head is still in this sort of business space. And he's also, is this a moment where he's open, maybe in the way that I'm open to a dissolve? He's like open to this. And he did such a lovely job because in the script I write, he drinks this tea and he has an expression, but we don't know if he likes it or dislikes, you know, that there is just like, we don't actually know how he's evaluating it. And there was a version where I had cut that scene out. And you're right. There's nothing lost in regard to the film itself. And for many people, maybe it would help pace it up. But the thing that was lost was just a moment of time with Jake before we go into this a little bit more dramatic conversation between Mika and Yang about being adopted. And it really was a bit of a palate cleanser, just a feeling of being with Jake really before this sort of burden and journey really begins to continue. And yeah, it was just a real palate cleanser, and not just a palate cleanser. I don't want to minimize it. I think there's a moment with Jake that felt really valuable because so much of what is happening for him is interior, and so much of why he's not paying attention to Mika is also his occupation with this sort of failing business. So there's just a lot of things I liked about it, writing it, and then just having a moment in time with him.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you,
and thanks for making this beautiful film. This is going to stay with me for a while. I will be thinking about this film for a long time to come.
Thank you. That means so much coming from you. And it was really lovely. I mean, these are questions and conversations, and I've been having a lot of them about the film, but this is so unique. And I love the questions you asked and really love the way you watched the film as well. And just some of the insights that you had and things that you noticed. It just means a lot. So thank you for inviting me. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
Okay.
So nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven, curated look at the art and craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, Koga Nada. Thanks to Sebastian Ray for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And keep an eye out on Frame.io's YouTube channel for upcoming video episodes of the Art of the Cut podcast. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening.